All participants will be in a listen-only. I would like to inform you all that today's call is.
Thank you, operator. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you all for joining us today. I hope everyone is safe and doing our social distancing. I know we are here at the Department of Commerce. We've got a great call today talking about price gouging and government investigations on that. Our speakers are Ed Heath and Kendra Berardi from Robinson & Cole. Robinson & Cole law firm here in Hartford is a very good friend of us. Ours works with us a great deal with many of our export clients, has been a winner of the President's Export Award, and they are on the Export Council. But opening up the call will be Senator Blumenthal, our U.S. Senator, our senior senator, who has a long career with Connecticut, being a state senator, and for, I think, almost 20 years, our attorney general. So he's very good on this topic. And Senator Blumenthal, thank you very much for joining us today. Please talk a little bit about this subject.
Great. Thank you so much, Anne, and thanks to you and your staff for coordinating this really essential outreach to the business community on so many different topics and issues, and certainly the one for today, price gouging, is not only timely but profoundly important. And I want to thank Ed and Kendra for providing their expertise on this topic. And as you mentioned, I know Robinson & Cole very, very well, not only for their work on export commerce, but also on so many other issues. In fact, I was at the Senate luncheon when Robinson & Cole was recognized by the Department of Commerce for their contributions to Connecticut business and the export economy. We really do live in extraordinary times, and I regret that we are meeting in this fashion. I look forward to the time when the Department of Commerce will continue the great seminars and sessions that it has in the past, person to person. But this world is one that involves extraordinary hardship and heartbreak. I've seen it over the last 3 weeks, not so much traveling around Connecticut as I usually do, but through the teleconferences and video conferences that I've had with so many different people in Connecticut, the small businesses who are struggling to survive and urgently trying to keep people on their payrolls and continue their businesses, families and workers who are trying to put food on the table and pay their utility and rent bills, advocates of domestic violence victims who fear that the levels of stress and anxiety are going to provoke vastly rising amounts of violence in our homes, and of course homeless advocates, nonprofits, heads of hospitals. We did one video conference just about 10 days ago with all the presidents of hospitals, and they are businesses, maybe nonprofit businesses, but they too are struggling to survive with diminishing revenues as well as rising caseloads. So this entire economy and our healthcare system is challenged as never before, and those pleas of urgency are one of the reasons why we put together the three emergency relief packages that have already passed the Congress. And let me focus for a moment on the third, which is the $2.2 trillion package. I know $2.2 trillion, hard to wrap our minds around that number. It's about the size of the federal budget, which normally takes us 6-7 months to put together. We did this package in 5 days. And, you know, there undoubtedly are ways it's imperfect, but it was imperative to do because we heard so repeatedly and constantly the pleas for urgency. And just to address the parts that are probably most relevant to this group, $350 billion goes to the Paycheck Promotion and Protection Program. Paycheck Protection Program will provide loans up to $10 million to small businesses with fewer than 500 employees. Those loans are forgivable. They can be converted to grants if the businesses keep those employees on their payrolls. They can also use it for rent, utilities, mortgage payments. It's basically designed to put money into the hands of small businesses that are struggling to get through these next couple of months. And for workers who are not continued to be employed, there is enhanced unemployment insurance, getting money into the hands of workers and their families, $600 on top of what they would receive now per week, $600 per week for 4 months. So that will bring a lot of workers near to what their normal pay is, maybe up to their normal pay for some. But again, putting money in their hands so they can pay the grocery bills and pay their rent and mortgages. And then a loan program for companies above 500 employees, low or no interest loans with worker retention requirements, tax credits for payroll, requirements for oversight and transparency, all of them checks on the use of this money so that taxpayers get their money's worth. And remember, this money is our money. It's taxpayers' money. Hospitals and healthcare facilities, a Marshall Medical Plan, Marshall Medical Plan, providing $130 billion for hospitals that are facing hard times, and then $30 billion for the ventilators, masks, protective equipment, gowns, and, of course, development of vaccines and therapeutics that are so necessary, and aid for state and local governments whose budgets have been just decimated, as we know here in Connecticut, $1.5 billion coming to Connecticut out of a total of $150 billion. All these programs are relevant, as is the $1,200 payment that will go to every individual, $1,200 to every individual who makes less than $75,000. There's a sliding, diminishing scale up to $100,000, but those payments will go directly into people's bank accounts deposited by the IRS based on 2018 tax returns. People who haven't filed taxes, tax returns, need to make application, but everyone else receives this money automatically, including Social Security recipients, including veterans, including people who owe child support or who owe taxes. No questions asked. $1,200 non-taxable to every individual, a kind of bridge for people to get through this very difficult couple of months. All of that said, what we're seeing is the need for a fourth package. We're working on it right now. We know it has to include more money for the small business programs. The majority leader, Mitch McConnell, went to the floor or made a public announcement yesterday about $250 billion more on top of the $350 billion. I think, and many of us on the other side of the aisle think, we need more money for medical assistance to those hospitals and for the purchases of essential equipment. We need more money into other programs that are essential for this fourth package. I'm hoping this one will be bipartisan, just like the first three. They were bipartisan. The last one voted and approved overwhelmingly, in fact, unanimously, and all the others overwhelmingly by nonpartisan, bipartisan majority. So just kind of a thumbnail sketch of what we're doing, big picture, on trying to help the economy survive this crisis. And it's an emergency that we are not going to solve economically unless we turn the tide on the coronavirus itself. The healthcare emergency has to be successfully addressed if we are really to revive and sustain our economy. So both have to be done simultaneously, and that's why we have adopted this strategy. Let me say a word about price gouging real quickly. I used to do this kind of work as Attorney General. I often miss that job, but we are fortunate in Connecticut to have some laws that help protect against price gouging, and we've seen some of it. On masks, for example, I've seen it personally. I've received complaints from consumers as well as hospitals about the increases in prices on even lower quality products, and some of these masks are really lower quality. We've also seen the markets for ventilators and other essential equipment become very, very difficult and very fertile for price gouging. And let me just say, we need intervention by the federal government. We need, in my view, a system for allocating this scarce essential equipment. Someone who will be the center of command, the administrator of FEMA, I talked to him, Peter Gaynor, just several days ago, has essentially said he can't do it. Well, the president, in my view, has to, in effect, appoint a czar or a point person to allocate this equipment where it is most needed. That's beginning to happen now, but we in this part of the country have a special stake in better leadership on this issue and use of the Defense Production Act to increase supply, because we will continue to see price gouging and other misallocation of this equipment until we increase the supply. It's a worldwide demand. There simply isn't enough supply right now, and that creates the fertile ground for price gouging. I have proposed a federal statute on price gouging, along with a number of my colleagues, including Senator Klobuchar, because there is no federal statute that specifically addresses price gouging. The FTC has limited authority in this area to go after misleading and deceptive practices, which is a very strong power if used correctly and aggressively, but no specific price gouging power and authority to go into court, seek injunctive and compensatory relief, which is what this bill would propose. So I think we need more effective federal action. I am seeking to add that kind of federal protection against price gouging to the next emergency relief package. My priority is continuing relief to address this emergency, and I'm hopeful that we will also help protect consumers and, frankly, the hospitals who need this kind of equipment for the protection of their healthcare workers who are on the front lines doing essential work, risking their lives because many of them lack enough masks and personal protective equipment and gowns and gloves to do what they need to do. So thank you so much for having me. Thanks again to Ann and the Department of Commerce staff. And I would be happy to answer questions. I know we won't have time right now because we're going to go straight into the presentation. But let me give you all my cell phone, 202-641-0532, 202-641-0532. If you have questions or difficulty accessing these programs, we have encountered a number of difficulties, particularly on the Paycheck Protection Program in small businesses accessing lenders. I think the lenders now are much more receptive. They've changed their policies to provide these loans to non-credit, non-loan customers, although I think they may still be limiting the loans to the folks, businesses who have payroll accounts or checking accounts. But any way that we can help in accessing any of these programs, or if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to let me know. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Senator, and we really appreciate you being on and giving out your cell phone number. Thank you so much. So,
I might just say, Ann, these are extraordinary times, and we want to be there for people, and frankly, I've done it with other business conferences that we've had on the phone, some as large as 250 people through the New Haven Chamber of Commerce. We've done almost all the chambers, or a lot of them around the state, with small businesses, and frankly, the calls that I've received have been enormously revealing. They've enlightened me about what's going on the ground, and we've also helped quite a few people, so I'm hoping that people will contact me if they have questions or comments.
Well, thank you very much. So, thank you, Senator. Let's go on to Ed and Kendra.
Thank you, Ann. Well, Kendra and I are honored to be a part of this program and also to be sharing the stage, at least virtually, with the Senator. So my name is Ed Heath. I'm a partner at Robinson & Cole, and I lead the firm's business litigation practice and its government enforcement practice. Kendra?
And I'm Kendra Berardi. I'm a partner in the business litigation practice group at Robinson & Cole, and my focus is on complex commercial litigation.
All right. So today we're going to talk about price gouging and related government investigations. Now, there are a lot of interesting aspects to this issue, political, economic, anecdotal, and it's a fairly fluid situation. But our goal today is that we want to provide you with some practical guidance to help your businesses navigate the legal aspects of this issue. I'm required to mention up front that we're not giving anyone specific legal advice, but, you know, we found with these calls that, you know, there are a number of folks who reach out to us after the fact and they may have some questions, and that doesn't necessarily require a formal engagement letter if it's, you know, an issue that we can help you kick around. When I say the term price gouging, it probably triggers in everyone's mind the person who's hoarding hand sanitizer in his garage, seeking to resell it on eBay for an 800% markup. And I assume that that's not the business model of anyone on this call, but instead you're here for an answer to the most important question, which is, how should my business go about setting prices for products or services that we sell without crossing the line into price gouging? And that's an important question, not only for all the safety reasons, I should say, that the Senator mentioned, but because price gouging can lead to civil and criminal government enforcement activity. And in the 20 years that I've been doing this kind of work, I've often seen it that well-intentioned companies find themselves facing investigation because they misunderstood or misapplied the relevant law, maybe because of oversight or carelessness, and even in some instances, the purposeful actions of a rogue employee. So enforcement activity can arise because a consumer complained or because one business complained about another. Sometimes it's because that one business is on the receiving end, in this instance, of price gouging, or it could be that one competitor is seeking to compete with the other competitor by making a complaint to the government. And I've seen investigations where the government develops a very sincere but substantially inaccurate impression of a company's activities. And in all those instances, what a company needs to be able to do is to put its best foot forward to help the government understand exactly what decisions were made and how they were made, because the consequences of a government investigation can be severe. In the extreme cases, it can lead to incarceration for owners of the company or the individuals involved in making decisions about price gouging. It can be financial penalties, court orders, as the Senator alluded to, injunctions, for example, that restrict business activities, loss of licensure, plus the loss of the ability to participate in government programs or receive funding, not to mention the soft but equally severe impacts such as reputational damage and loss of goodwill. And price gouging, of all things, is a politically charged issue at this point, rightfully so, but that's also likely to mean that there may be harsher consequences and harsher penalties sought as the government demonstrates decisive action. So, with that, let's turn to the substance of it. Kendra?
Thanks, Ed. So, So there's really four questions we hope to provide some guidance on today. And those questions are, what is price gouging? Who can be subject to a price gouging claim? Who can bring a price gouging claim? And what are the potential penalties you face if you are found to have violated one of those statutes? So the first one, what is price gouging? The term price gouging is often misused. In a legal sense, what it means is charging excessively high prices for products or services during an emergency declaration or other unusual or abnormal market conditions. It's important to understand, as Ed said, that there is some limited federal law, but it's really a state law issue, and it varies from state to state. So it's important when you're reviewing this issue to make sure you understand the law of the state where you're selling, and we will get into that in some detail a little bit. The second is, who can be subject to a price gouging claim? And the answer is pretty simple. It's businesses and individuals. It's businesses selling directly to consumers, but it's also businesses in the supply chain, suppliers, manufacturers, distributors, wholesalers, and it can be a brick-and-mortar store, or it can be an online marketplace that's either reselling itself or allows reselling. Who can bring a price gouging claim varies by state, but in certain instances, federal prosecutors from the U.S. Department of Justice could bring a price gouging claim. More likely, you're going to see a claim from a state attorney general or potentially a state prosecutor, which would be initiated by a complaint from a member of the public, either a consumer or a business within the supply chain. It's also possible in some jurisdictions that private citizens, consumers themselves, or businesses can bring their own action for price gouging in a civil context. And just like who can bring a price gouging claim, penalties for price gouging vary from state to state. When the penalty is criminal, the most significant penalty, as Ed mentioned, can be incarceration. For example, Connecticut can allow up to 1 year in prison. There's also the potential for civil fines, which can run into the tens of thousands of dollars and can be fined per violation with sometimes a maximum per 24-hour period. Courts can also enter orders enjoining businesses from continuing to sell the product, and those injunctions can be temporary for the length of the litigation, but they could also be permanent. You could also face revocation of your license to do business or a potential loss of federal or state funding. So as Ed said, the penalties can be severe. It's important to understand the laws of the jurisdiction in which you're operating. With that, I'll turn it over to Ed for a discussion of what the federal landscape looks like.
Right. So if we were talking about this issue a month ago, we would be telling you that there really aren't federal concerns with respect to price gouging. As Senator Blumenthal mentioned, there is no federal statute that prohibits it. There have been multiple attempts in the past to pass such a law, but they have repeatedly failed. And the FTC's last official position is that price gouging laws are bad for the economy. We won't take up everyone's time with the economic arguments on both sides of this issue. I will just say that this morning, The Economist posted an article on its website that looks at both sides of the economic analysis and comes out that price gouging laws are, in fact, not bad for the economy, particularly in these circumstances. But that leaves us with no federal law. However, as of about a week and a half ago, or 2 weeks ago, rather, at this point, there was a development that changed the landscape. The president issued an executive order on March 23rd, and it was pursuant to the Defense Production Act. And that order prohibits the hoarding of designated items. More specifically, it allows the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services to designate certain items as protected. And once those items are designated, it's a federal crime for any person or business to accumulate that designated item in excess of his or her reasonable needs or its reasonable needs for the purpose of selling that item in excess of, quote, prevailing market prices. Now, HHS has issued a list of those designated items. It's available online, and it principally focuses on the, as you'd expect, ventilators, face masks, and other personal protective equipment. Department of Justice has set up a COVID-19 task force. It's made up of federal prosecutors from each state, and their job is, among other things, to prosecute price gouging under that order. It is not really a comprehensive statutory scheme, as Blumenthal noted, although there is one particular United States attorney who has been put in charge of that program, there is no administrator, no czar, as the senator mentioned, who's really overseeing these issues. Now, the executive order uses the phrase prevailing market prices, and I will tell you that that provides little guidance to businesses. There's no explanation of how that term should be applied in these circumstances, and you can look at different areas of law where that term is used, and it's still hard to compile from those a set of concrete guidance for businesses trying to comply with this law. I can tell you that that the interpretation of that phrase will be the central ground of legal dispute in any prosecution that occurs. But I think you can glean some guidance from that. Look, here's the takeaway. If you're selling something at a price that's noticeably more than it was selling for before the pandemic, you may get investigated and prosecuted. You'll want to look at what your competition is doing. If they're selling noticeably below your price, that's a problem. But even if they're selling at or close to your price, that won't help you either because they too could be selling it above prevailing market rate. The best thing to do is take a look at state law, which does have carve-outs for things like increased expenses, and we'll come back to that in a minute. The only other thing I want to mention at the federal level is that, you know, the DOJ prosecutors have at their disposal some very general criminal statutes, such as those that are used to go after mail fraud or antitrust conduct or price fixing. And it allows them to pursue a wide variety of what I'll call bad conduct for which there isn't an express law. And so at this point, I do expect that to the extent we have price gouging conduct for some reason can't be reached by executive order, that the very creative lawyers at the DOJ will find ways to fit that conduct into other federal statutes. But again, I think the thing to do is to really look to the state law for guidance, which varies from state to state. Kendra?
Thanks, Ed. So in addition to that new federal guidance on price gouging, states do have their own individual laws. These laws can impose both civil and criminal penalties for price gouging and are generally divided into three general categories. There are states which impose what we would call a no unusual increase law, laws which prohibit unconscionable price increases, and laws which impose a specific percentage cap on price increases. In Connecticut, there are two specific price gouging statutes. The first applies to retail products, which are being sold after the governor declares a state of emergency, and the other only applies when the governor has specifically declared a supply emergency, which we'll discuss. That first statute, as I said, is triggered by a declaration of emergency by the governor or the president of the United States and prohibits increasing the price of any item offered for retail sale, provided that the increase was not due to normal business fluctuation. And that distinction is really important. What it means is that a price increase caused by normal market conditions is not price gouging. It's really the difference between raising the price of Lysol wipes during a public health emergency because you want to increase your profit when the demand is high among consumers and increasing the price of a face shield that you're producing for medical use because the resin that you need to produce that face shield is in short supply and your costs of acquiring that desperately needed product are going up. And so you raise the price of the face shield to account for your increased cost. In other words, Connecticut, like most of the states that we're going to discuss today, understands that normal economic laws are not suspended during a public emergency. The normal supply and demand conditions that may lead to price increases in the market are going to continue to exist, and price increases as a result of those conditions would not be considered price gouging. And in fact, last month, the Office of the Connecticut Attorney General issued a handout entitled Coronavirus and Price Gouging in Connecticut, which essentially says exactly that. Violators of this first statute in Connecticut can face fines and, more significantly, face a determination that the violation is a per se unfair or deceptive trade practice in Connecticut, which allows harsher penalties per violation, including punitive damages, actual damages, recovery of enforcement costs, and injunctive relief. That second relevant statute in Connecticut is triggered only where the governor of Connecticut specifically declares a supply emergency, which exists when the governor determines that there is either a statewide or regional shortage or threatened shortage of specific products or services due to an abnormal market disruption. So that's things like face masks or hand sanitizer in the case of a public health emergency. In that case, the governor would designate specific products that the government has found to be in short supply or in danger of being in short supply. And that it would prohibit price increases on those specific products. Even there, however, Connecticut would allow a price increase which is attributable to additional costs incurred by the seller in connection with the acquisition, production, distribution, or sale of the product or service. So again, if your cost of producing the item have gone up, then a comparable increase in the sale price of the item is not price gouging. It's not taking advantage of an abnormal market condition to make more money than you were making before the disruption. The primary difference in those two statutes really lies in the penalties for violation. Like the first statute, violators of the supply emergency statute face penalties under the Consumer Protection Act, but that public supply emergency statute also subjects violators of a fine of up to $1,000 per violation and criminal penalties, including up to a year in prison. If you're found to have willfully or knowingly violated that statute, the penalties go up to a fine of up to $5,000 per violation or up to 5 years in prison. Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New York have statutes which fall into the no unconscionable price increase category, with one exception, which we'll discuss. Massachusetts regulates price gouging via its consumer protection statute, which makes it an unfair or deceptive practice during a statewide or national emergency to sell or offer to sale goods or services necessary for the health, safety, or welfare of the public at an unconscionably high price. When considering whether a price is unconscionably high, it's important to understand that what a court's going to look to, as Ed said, is the price at which that good or service was offered prior to the emergency and what it's being offered at after the emergency. The court will probably also look at what the readily obtainable price from competitors for that same product or service are. Again, Massachusetts recognizes that normal market conditions are not suspended during a public emergency. And as a result, in Massachusetts, if you can show that your costs of producing that item have gone up via factors outside your control, like the case of the resin for your face masks that I mentioned before, then increasing your price per sale comparably to preserve the profit that you were making prior to the declaration of emergency is not going to be considered price gouging. Violators in Massachusetts face similar penalties to Connecticut, up to $5,000 per violation, and the potential for double or treble damages in the case of a willful and knowing violation. Rhode Island statute is triggered again by the declaration of an emergency by the governor or a federal disaster declaration by the president. Rhode Island's very similar to Massachusetts. You can't have an unconscionably high price increase for essential commodities that are being sold to consumers. Essential commodities are exactly what you think they are going to be. They're going to be things that consumers need in the case of an emergency, like food or water or fuel. Again, in Rhode Island, the same considerations are going to apply when you're determining whether a price is unconscionably high. What were you selling the product for before the declaration of emergency, and what are you selling it for now? And why has your price gone up? If you can point to a rising cost that was outside your control and you can show a correlation between your rising cost and the cost of the price for sale that you're offering your product at, that's probably not price gouging. That's a recognition that businesses continue to need to make a profit to operate even during a public emergency. In fact, Rhode Island even will take into account whether or not if you were offering the item for a discount prior to the declaration of emergency and you have a limited ability to offer that item for a discount or a limited number of rebates available, Rhode Island will even deduct that discounted price from its calculation to determining whether your price increase was unconscionably high. Penalties for violation in Rhode Island are very similar, $1,000 per fine, capped at $25,000 per 24-hour period, and potentially paying the cost of litigation related to the offense. Rhode Island could also look for disgorgement of any profits earned that were in violation of the statute, and broadly any other relief that the court determines to be appropriate. New York, again, has a law which specifically prohibits manufacturers, suppliers, distributors, retailers, and any other people within the chain of distribution from charging an unconscionably excessive price for an item during an abnormal disruption in the market, or when an abnormal disruption is imminently threatened. That the New York statute can be enforced only by the Attorney General, and it applies to goods and services used for personal, family, or household purposes. In New York, what they're going to look at in terms of whether or not a price was unconscionably high is, again, what you were offering the product for prior to the declaration of emergency and the increase in price after the declaration of emergency. But New York will go a step further. And the second factor they will look at is whether or not there was an exercise of unfair leverage or unconscionable means in raising the price. So what that means is that under New York law, even a modest price increase could be considered price gouging if it's determined that the business is capitalizing on a bargaining advantage caused by the emergency or other disaster. So in other words, if you are leveraging a state of emergency to take advantage of panic buying, the fact that you only raised your price a little when you could have raised it a lot probably won't save you. Violators of this statute in New York face penalties including injunctive relief prohibiting further sales, civil penalties up to $25,000, and the potential restitution to any aggrieved consumers. I said there was one exception in New York, and it applies specifically to New York City, because on March 16th, the New York City Department of Consumer and Worker Protection announced an emergency rule as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic that prohibits as price gouging any price increase above 10% for any personal or household good or any service that is needed to prevent or limit the spread of or treat COVID-19. The DCWP did provide specific examples. They are non-exclusive, but they do include what you'd expect: cleaning products, diagnostic products and services, disinfectants, etc. This rule imposed by New York City is an example of that third category of price gouging laws, a specific percentage cap. But even in the case of New York City, which has employed this 10% percentage cap increase, price increases which are caused by an increased cost to the seller of production or supply are permitted, so long as the increases are comparable. As you can see, each of these categories has a fair amount of fluidity in their definitions. That fluidity can be frustrating, but it is necessary to allow for the different conditions and circumstances which might be caused by a public health emergency versus a natural disaster like a hurricane or tornado. What's important to learn from each of these is that a review of the state law in which you are operating and offering items for sale is important before setting any prices or raising any prices after the declaration of an emergency. So I'll turn it over to Ed for a discussion of defendants.
Yeah, so for a lot of your heads may be spinning now, given all these standards that we've just gone through. But, you know, we wanted to demonstrate that it really does vary. The standards for conduct really do vary from state to state. There are some themes that in our nationwide analysis are common. And one of the most common and really most important themes for businesses to keep in mind is that law in every jurisdiction recognizes that you're allowed to make a profit. You're allowed to make a reasonable profit, and that conditions may exist that justify a price increase, conditions beyond your control, conditions that are inevitable. And so here's the key takeaway. Not every price increase during a public emergency is considered gouging. Wrinkle that comes with these statutes, a lot of these statutes, is that they can be interpreted to shift the burden of proof. And that's something that we lawyers love to talk about, but just from a general understanding, I'm sure everyone knows that, you know, when the government brings a case against you, they've got to prove their case. Here, the way some of these statutes are written, it's possible that the burden of proof will shift to the company to defend itself. Once the government shows that the price has changed, it may then argue that it's on the business to show that the price change was reasonable and justifiable. Now, I mention that because in order to best position your business, if you're any pricing changes over the next couple of months, what you'll want to do is keep very good records of the grounds for making those changes. And so to give you a really concrete context, I'll talk about some of the costs that have been recognized in cases around the country in when there's been a price gouging application. And the justifiable costs have included things like transportation, payroll costs. Those may increase. Maybe overtime work has to be paid to meet demand. Materials costs. Some things can be harder to get. Shipping costs can increase. There may be just the usual and customary seasonal fluctuations with manufacturing or sales. There could be taxes, increased government expenses, or other processing fees that may go up, or technology costs because you've got employees working remotely, for instance. All of those can be justified. A price increase in the context of emergency. I did find one case from New York court about 30 some odd years ago, that the company was defending itself, saying that freight charges were three times higher than it would otherwise have been. But after the government did some digging and the court really looked closely at the facts, there was a determination that the company had failed to demonstrate that the shipments were all similar in size to the shipments that were done earlier. In other words, the implication was that these additional costs were because the company was buying more product, and so the shipping costs were higher. But as you read that, it's hard to walk away without thinking that the poor business that's caught in this position will really prove through its records that was passing along a reasonable, unavoidable cost. Now, even if you can demonstrate, or even if you're sitting there in your office and you're saying, do we raise prices because we have these increased costs, there are a couple of countervailing considerations I'd like everyone to think of. First, is the proposed price increase that you're contemplating proportionate to increased costs? There's plenty of guidance out there that says, look, if your costs go up by 5%, you can't increase the price by another 20%. Got to be proportional. Next, is the cost increase something that's being imposed by a third party, or is the cost increase a result of something that's controllable within your company? Can you take reasonable measures to limit that cost? I would imagine there may be some intercompany dealings where you've got a parent company subsidiary, and maybe the subsidiary is supplying some things and they're increasing their cost, but the parent has the ability to really make changes to the subsidiary's charges. So it really should be a cost that's being imposed by outside of your control. Another question is, did other costs decrease? You may be looking at shipping and saying, well, that's gone up, but maybe the material cost has gone down. If so, you can't ignore that cost decrease. You can't simply raise your price by 5% because transportation costs have gone up by 5% if your materials costs have gone down by 5%. I realize that the math is not going to work out that perfectly, but I say that for illustration purposes. You have to take all the costs into consideration. You can't just cherry pick one. Another interesting argument that I've seen somewhere is that there was an item discounted recently. It had been 20% off. But then the public emergency came, and the price was not only restored to normal, but increased by 5%. The company was trying to defend it by saying, hey, look, it wasn't a 25% increase because of this. It was only a 5% increase. It just the product happened to be on sale a few weeks ago. Well, the way the government's going to look at that, and rightfully so, is that market conditions drove the business to put that item on sale or to reduce the price of that item. So the market conditions, the prevailing market rate at the time of crisis is that discounted price. So keep in mind, if you're thinking of raising the price, ask yourself, what has our price been over the last 3 months, 6 months, and why has it been discounted if it's been discounted? Now, regardless of the actual cost increases, I will just tell you from experience that a very substantial increase in price, a gross increase in price, alone might be considered evidence of gouging. If you can justify it with some increased cost, you have to keep in mind that price on a product is a good chance to get the government's attention. And we look at that and say there's a difference between what ultimately went at trial and say we weren't gouging and whether you're going to draw the interest of the government, because there's no such thing as an inexpensive government investigation. There are just costs and disruptions that come along with it. As you're looking at balancing your increase in price and your increase in cost, just think of how big of a step you're actually taking. Another scenario is this a new item of your business that you happen to be selling at a price that is above the historic prevailing market price for other sellers because it costs you significantly more? And let me be very concrete with an example. You know, say that you're a shoe store. I know this is a simplified example, but you're running a shoe store. You sell shoes. And then you decide that you're going to start selling those N95 masks. You reach out to someone who will sell those to you. You're now selling them in your shoe store for, you know, 10 times what the price had been 3 months ago. You might think to yourself, look, I had to pay, you know, 9 times the price for these before, so I have a really substantial cost here. I think if you're adding a completely new and unrelated product to your roster, you won't be able to defend selling that at a gouged price simply because you paid a gouged price to the person you bought it from. Ultimately, you want to ask yourself, are we increasing this price because of increased market demand that's due to the crisis or due to the emergency versus the ordinary and customary business expenses or increases or disruptions that are otherwise going independent of the crisis? And if you're making a pricing decision that's tied to the crisis, you really have to be able to justify those costs. All right. Now, in the lead up to the call, Ann brought up a very good example. She said, what about the company that's deciding it's going to do some public good and sell its product, say, to a Connecticut hospital at its cost? So they're not trying to profit at all. If the company does that, but then they get, you know, requests to start selling the product elsewhere outside of Connecticut, is the fact that they've sold the product at cost going to be evidence of price gouging when they sell to, you know, a state or local government outside of Connecticut or private parties outside of Connecticut? Obviously, the answer to that question turns on what's the law in the jurisdiction into which you're going to be selling. You know, say you're going to sell that product outside of Connecticut and into California, you have to know what California law says with respect to pricing. I will tell you that as a general matter, it's very unlikely that doing that kind of public good is going to be held against the company. Obviously, not being sold at cost in Connecticut is a product that is not being sold at a prevailing market price. So you should be able to point to those transactions in Connecticut and say, those market transactions, the sale we're making into California, for example, is at market level. Now, we had included with today's presentation a PowerPoint that Antonio were good enough to load up onto the website. And as those of you who are aware of the PowerPoint scene, we haven't been following that slide. But at the end of that PowerPoint is a list of 10 best practices that we'd like everyone to keep in mind. There's no one-size-fits-all, set of best practices when it comes to pricing, but these are the general measures that are most adaptable to all businesses. And really the goal of these is to, you know, not only stay within the general requirements of the law for price setting, but also to prepare you in the event that you do get a knock on your door from the government and they're asking about a particular price increase that you've implemented. You want to be able to demonstrate that you've got good faith practices, that you've got managers and senior employees who understand rules with respect to price increases, and that as company leadership, there's been a set of clear expectations that were expressed to follow those rules, and ultimately that you have records to support those decisions. So I'll just spend a couple of minutes quickly going through those so that we have a few minutes for questions. But I want everyone to keep in mind a maxim that I learned years ago and has proven itself to be right time and time again. And the cost of compliance is almost always less than the cost of a crisis. So as you're thinking about these measures that we're suggesting here for you, you may look and say, oh, that's going to take some time or that's going to take some added cost. But I can tell you that those costs will almost certainly pale in comparison to what could happen in the event the government knocks on your door. So step one is to identify all the states in which your products are sold either directly or through other companies. If you're in the supply chain, you want to try to identify where your products are likely to be sold. You want to obtain guidance from legal counsel about each relevant state's specific price fixing or price gouging laws. And you want to find out do products fall within the scope of the law. In Connecticut, you heard earlier, the law is very broad. It covers any product sold at retail, for instance. And you also want to find out under each state's law what type of exceptions or justifications exist. As I said, generally if the cost, your cost is increased, then you have that justification for a price increase. But some of the state's laws are a little more aggressive in what they'll allow and not allow. Third, you want to develop internal written policies that guide how company prices are set. And I know what everyone's thinking, how am I going to go about drafting those? They're complicated. Yes, lawyers can help you with those, but they're generally going to be a very simple set of policies. First of all, if they're too complex, no one can follow them. You don't want to be rigid and formulaic. It should be, but it should still be detailed. I can't tell you how many times I've seen compliance policies of our clients where it simply says, we don't do X. Well, that's a nice mission statement, but it's not really a policy employees about how to do something. So you don't simply want to have a nice one paragraph that says, you know, we don't gouge prices and exploit, you know, the public in times of emergency. That's a great opening line, but there should be detailed guidance that goes along with it. And you should make sure those policies are properly circulated to everyone in the company who needs to see them. And they should be delivered with a message from management or from the person responsible for this that explains how important these policies are. And ultimately, you want to instruct policies, all employees, to redirect any price gouging allegations or concerns that are addressed to one designated person. If it's practical, next, you want to try to look which employees can set prices. That doesn't have to be your practices around the clock, but certainly in time of an emergency, you want to have one designated employee or a small subset of employees who are responsible for pricing. And those are the individuals that you want to formally train. Talking about a lunchtime chat or a conversation in the hallway, I'm talking about sitting down with those written policies or sitting down and having a detailed discussion. Ideally, you'll host a very short training session. It doesn't have to be a half day. It can be an hour. But you'll keep a record of training with the date, the time that it ran, the location where it was held, who presented, who attended, you know, have a sheet, and identify what documents were distributed and keep a record of that. The reason for that is that if you do end up getting a knock on the door from the government, you want to demonstrate the steps that you took to make your employees follow. Because even in the best, you know, companies with well-trained employees, you do have rogue employees who pay attention or don't care. And one of the company's best defenses or best mitigating factors may be pointing to this kind of training. With those employees who are responsible for pricing, you want to direct them to maintain complete record related to the price increase. We call this mitigation evidence. You want them to keep the purchase orders, the invoices, the shipping records, receipts, any email back and forth that would reflect how the pricing decisions were made. It's also good to be aware of what your competitors are doing in terms of pricing. But I want to warn everyone, do not go about any kind of agreements, whether express or implied, with your pricing. That creates a whole other area of exposure. But just be aware of what they're doing. Be also aware of your own historical pricing data. And I'd recommend that you have these documents all maintained electronically, not in a paper copy of these desks where they can be lost or misplaced. I'll also throw out another suggestion, which is to operate a complaint portal on your website and or Facebook page. Customers report their price concerns directly to you. It increases the odds that you'll have the opportunity to address one of the issues before the government intervenes. And, you know, even if one goes directly to the government, having that kind of a portal shows good faith. You don't have to say, hey, if you think we're gouging prices, you know, sign in here. But there could be something clearly marked that says if there's any concerns about what the company is doing with respect to any matters, including pricing, we'd love to hear from you. Please click here. Then you want to have a short form there that asks for things like name, telephone number, and email address. But at the same time, you also want a lot of reports to be made anonymously, because you might have one something another employee is doing. And you'd like to be able to capture that without the person having a fear of reprisal. So you want to have that portal open to the public as well as to your employees. And it should generate an email to senior personnel at the company. At a minimum, you want to designate one person at the company who's responsible for those. I've seen some messy situations with clients where one person with clear responsibility to address complaints, and everyone thinks someone else has handled it. I also think that, coming from my experience as a trial, you really want to avoid internal email discussions once an allegation of price gouging is raised or concerns about price gouging raised. You know, one of my colleagues has a great line. He says, emails are God's gift to trial lawyers, and they can be, because they often contain unguarded or thoughtless statements. So while I wouldn't recommend anyone sends an email around and don't ever put anything in an email, when you're talking to your managers and your salespeople and people who are in charge of pricing, encourage them to pick up the phone rather than send an email. Obviously, you know, all of our businesses are based on email, so I'm not telling you to stop using email, but encourage people to use that phone. So I see that we're almost out of time, but I wanted to make sure that we leave at least a little bit of time for any questions that anyone may have. So, Anne, I'll turn it back to you.
Operator, are you on?
Yes. If you would like to ask a question,
okay.
Press star.
Yes. Thank you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you'd like to ask a question, press star 1, unmute your line and speak it when prompted, as your name is required to introduce your question. And if you'd like to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Moment as we wait for questions.
Ed and Kendra, thank you for this very complete, incredibly complete, whole statewide explanation. And for your listeners, it is up on our website, our special topics website, so you can find it there. You can go through the notes. If you have any questions, please ask them now. And, operator, any questions come in?
I'm showing no questions in queue.
Okay. Well, if you do have questions, please, you can email me, and I will pass them on to Ed and Kendra. And Ed and Kendra, thank you so much. I really appreciate this. This call was recorded, and the recording will also be on the website. So, everyone, have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.